I still face fears. I mean, we still have that, especially as entrepreneurs, but it just redefined that fear. And so that helped me make that first step, which I may not have otherwise done at that time.
Welcome to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Series. My name is Adam Arkfeld, an entrepreneur, marketer, and seeker of high-performing habits, tips, and strategies. Each week, I'll bring to you an elite performer, a legal expert, or simply a strategy to help you see and follow the path to personal greatness in your firm and life. Thank you for joining us today. Now let's get started. Welcome everyone to the High Performance Legal Entrepreneur Podcast. I'm your host, Adam Arkfeld, president and founder of Prevail Legal Marketing. And today I have Jay Sherrill joining me. Jay is the founder and owner of Sherrill Law PC. Jay, thanks for joining us today.
Hi, how are you today?
Good, thank you. I appreciate you joining us on the podcast, and I'm really excited to hear more about your story and just sort of dive into your law firm. So, you know, we interview a lot of sort of consultants and providers and kind of third-party people on this podcast, and so I'm excited to be talking to another attorney. So tell me a little bit about just your background and where you were before you started your firm, and just give me a brief overview of kind of where you started and where you are now.
Oh, fantastic. Thanks so much for having me. Looking forward to it. So I started the law firm. I was about a year and a half out of law school, just had my second daughter. She was born premature. And when she got home from the hospital, she'd been there for 2 months, but just made the decision that now was the time to make the leap to open a law firm if that is what I wanted to do. I gave it some soul searching and figured this is exactly what I want to do. And now's the time to do it. And going through that experience with my daughter made that really helpful, because it made me realize there's nothing worse that could come from any of this that we didn't already go through with her. So that was a big push.
Yeah. So, so your daughter was born premature, and that kind of caused you to sort of reflect on just what's important in life. I mean, that kind of like the mentality that arose out of that.
It gave me the ability to reflect on what was important in life. It also gave me the, I guess, the lack of fear, changed my definition of fear. And I think a lot of times what helps us, what holds us back is fear. I still face fear. I mean, we still have that, especially as entrepreneurs, but it just redefined that fear. And so that helped me make that first step, which I may not have otherwise done at that time.
Really interesting. I will often hear people talk about adversity as being a way that it, and then I think it sounds like there's also the case for you where it sort of redefines priorities, but I've never heard someone say that the adversity itself changed the perception of like what they're afraid of. And then, you know, gave you more confidence, I guess, is kind of what it did to start your own firm.
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Because I mean, again, it didn't get rid of the fear. The fear is still there, and every day, you know, it stops you from doing things. And at the end of the day, right, you are only a reflection of the decisions and the actions that you took and made. And we often are held back by fear that we can't do it, that this isn't me, I don't deserve it, it will be too hard, it won't work. That kind of helped reshape that. So to me, it was like, what's the worst thing that'll happen? I'll go back and get a job.
Yeah, I was just going to ask that question. I was just going to ask that question if you remembered what that worst case scenario was at the time.
And to me, it was all right. So I'll burn through some savings and I'll go back and get a job. I mean, still employable, still have skills. This is money.
Yeah. So talk to me a little bit about those early days when you first started the firm. You know, you were out of law school a year and a half. So, some experience in law, I mean, not in law, but in, you know, being at another firm. But how did you, you know, what were the first things that you did when you started the firm, and what was sort of the biggest challenges that you faced right out of the gate?
One of the first things I did was I bought the book, How to Start and Manage or Start and Grow a Law Firm by Jay Foomberg. It's one of the best top sellers on the ABA. Great, fantastic book to start with. But ultimately, it's not about the book. I sought out help. I sought out resources to try to frame everything. I mean, I really think you have to be a planner. Now we also happen to do estate planning, so that also ties in with that for me as well. But if you're going to start a law practice, you plan it out. So I didn't just quit my job. I first bought that book, started to read that. But that's not enough. I mean, if you're just seeking knowledge, it feels good to get that knowledge. But if you don't actually take it and make it real, then it's just ideas. So the next step I took after having got that book was I then made the commitment to myself that I was going to quit my job on a certain date and I was going to start the practice on a certain date. Almost arbitrary in a sense, but it was a commitment. And then once I had that commitment to myself, I then went and I expressed that commitment to others. So I put that into the world. I went and told my wife, I'm doing this, told my parents, I told my in-laws, and everybody was crazy. Everybody was like, oh no, you can't do that. What, you have two kids at home? You just got home from the hospital. They'll all tell you now they always knew we could do it, but everybody said no. But I made the commitment. I said, this is what I'm doing. And between the making the commitment to myself and the commitment to them, there was no way when that day came that I was supposed to quit my job and start the firm, open my doors, that I was not going to do it, because I'd be letting myself down. I'd be letting everybody else down, and that was just not going to happen. So I made it real.
When that day came, was it easy to quit your job?
No, I was shaking. I was probably the the second most nervous I ever was, besides the time when I asked my wife to marry me. I was shaking that day too, trembling, you know. I went into the managing partner's office that day, and there was no easy way to put it. I mean, I really enjoyed working there. I enjoyed the family that I was working with, and I enjoyed the mentor that I had. But I had to quit in 2 weeks and let them know that I was leaving. And it wasn't him. It was me. I just needed to go. And something I just needed to do. So it was very hard. But once it was over, it was that conversation was over. It was like, well, I asked my wife to marry me. I mean, it was like all this built up in your head, trembling in the voice when you're having the conversation, and then like just, you know, a freedom after it was done. Yeah, that's when the real work began.
it's like any hard conversation. You know, once you have the conversation, it's the buildup that's so much more stressful than. I mean, the conversations themselves can sometimes be stressful. But once you're done, you know, it's like if you have the unfortunate, circumstance of having to let an employee go or something like that.
Sure.
It's once it's done, it just all the pressure releases and you don't have to think about it as much anymore. And you always feel better, right?
Absolutely. And we let that pressure, and I think that pressure, again, is a fear of accomplishing that task. At least that's how I would define it for myself, is something that we sit with and tolerate. And many people continue to tolerate it way past its time, and we all do it. But it impacts everything, and having to make that decision, make that commitment, and then following through with it has been the biggest thing. And I often find when you look back at those big rocks that we need to move, for example, that's a big boulder, quitting the job and starting the practice. When we have to move those rocks, when we look back, they're pebbles.
Yeah. Well, I love how you made the commitment to yourself, and then you made the commitment to other people. And then it's like, once you get there, you almost don't have a choice, right? It's like,
there was no turning back at that point.
Yeah. You're just, everyone's committed.
Back in with my tail between my legs and say, you know, hey, Andrew, I was just kidding. I'm going to stay on board. And yeah. I just couldn't do it.
Well, I've set goals for myself before, and the ones that I post about most publicly, you know, on social media or whatever, and I haven't accomplished them, are the ones that haunt me the most, you know? And, you know, that's a goal. So it's, you know, well, I guess it's very similar, but when you put it out there to other people, the accountability just ramps up so much. And I think it's great that you did that. I mean, that's amazing. So when you first started your firm, how did you get your first client or your first set of clients? I mean, were you like, all right, I'm opening up the doors. I'm like, I don't have anybody. I mean, how did you go about finding new clients with a brand new firm?
Sure. So I made the decision right off the bat that I wasn't going to go and go after the clients that I had helped at the law firm that I left. I was out of law school a year and a half, but I had only been practicing licensed practice for about 7 to 8 months at that point. So I didn't really have anybody that I had brought in or generated that I wanted to take out with me. So I made that decision. I'd rather preserve the relationship with that firm and start going and trying to pick and poach clients. They also didn't really necessarily do the practice that I set out to do, which was estate planning, and they were more of a general practice law firm. So that was out of the door. So what I did was basically, looking back on it, I call it now, is get into the hustle, market, sell. And I just got out there. I just hit the pavement. I focused on letting my inner circle know, right? So I think if you read Bob Berg, right, Endless Referrals, he'll say it's about 210 people. I got announcements out. Let everybody know that I'd started a law practice. And I would think that absolutely zero clients came from that. they just don't. I mean, at the end of the day, they want that circle is that, you know, you just started this brand new business. They're not looking to sign up to be client number one. I didn't find leads. Not to say that you shouldn't do it. I think it was great because many of those people did become clients down the road. And they were happy to know that they were one of the first to know. They just weren't early adopters of the business. It was really from just getting out there and identifying centers of influence. Okay. And then really in order to do that, I had to do some searching about who do we want to be as a firm? Who do we want to serve and how do we want to do it? And I identified that we would serve people through helping them do estate planning, helping them draw up their affairs so they could protect assets for their children, protect assets for their loved ones, not have to write extra checks to the government, right? Do it as easy as possible. And when we did that, I was able to then say, as enticing as that check for that other matter, or a bankruptcy matter, that real estate closing is, we don't want it. It's not what we do. So right from the get-go, we didn't open up as a general practice law firm. So that helped. Not to say I've made my fair share of mistakes in taking in additional work that we shouldn't have done. We probably still do it. But that helped us identify then who could put us in touch with those people that we're looking for. And I identified that to be accountants and financial advisors, because they would already have a know, like, and trust relationship with the client that I'm looking for. So now I just need to build a relationship with that one person. And I have to now get trust from them that they could send a client to me. And it started with just one. And I built another relationship with another person. It started with just one. And I built another relationship and started with just one. But then we did a great job for the one client. And it just started to snowball from there. Many of those referral sources became partners. Many of those clients that the referral sources referred became clients. And so I would say to you, for the first 2.5 years, through $500,000 of annual revenue, it was the entire source of the marketing, was from just meeting people, going to BNI, going to the Chamber of Commerce, going to a LATIP group. And I'd say going to, is we could talk about how to do all of this in a whole, you know, deep dive. You can't just go there. We have to go with that plan of getting out there, meeting those centers of influence, providing them with value. And what I found was you couldn't go asking for the business. What I actually found really early on was that attorneys suck. They suck. And you would think all these financial advisors had great relationships with great attorneys who all provided wonderful services to their clients. But every single one I met either didn't know somebody or had worked with someone in the past, but then, you know, they didn't respond to their clients. The clients were complaining back to them, so they stopped referring them. So I found that they really didn't have good relationships with them. So we could be a great value and a great resource for those financial advisors and accountants, those referral partners, by doing great work for their clients, because then they look like rock stars.
Now, so accountants and financial advisors, and it sounds like you got access to them through BNI and Chamber of Commerce events, those types of things. Is that how you got introduced to them?
Certainly. In the beginning, it was much more broad. I would do broad groups like that. At a certain point, as you continue to grow the business, it's not going to be cost effective or time effective for you to be in a LATIP group every Tuesday morning at 7:30 with the same 5 people in that group, 10 people in the group. But that was a great start. Was to get in front and build those relationships from those groups. The Chambers of Commerce can be fantastic. The Bar Association can be fantastic. For me, one of the things I started to add on when I got more strategic about it in the future was focusing on attorney accountant networking groups, senior citizen providers, networking groups. We have one here in our local area that does all things for senior citizens, getting with those people that might be in touch with our ideal clients, and then vice versa for us as well, to be able to provide referrals back.
Now, so you mentioned that you would walk into these events with a plan. One of the things that we've experienced, we we do quite a bit with partnerships as well. You know, we just do pay-per-click advertising. So anyone that's doing anything else, SEO is a really good referral partner for us. If they just do SEO, that we refer back and forth. How do you maintain the relationship moving forward? So you meet them and you say, hey, this is what I do. We could be a good partner, blah, blah, blah. How do you personally maintain that relationship? I mean, do you check in on quarterly? What's that look like?
That's a great question. So the approach that I took early on back then, when this was just me and the laptop and business cards, really had a, right from the get-go, a contact management software. Doesn't have to be crazy. You don't have to pay for anything huge. Set it up. Just get something in place. Could be cloud-based subscription. Start small. I met people. I put that information in there. I wrote down every time when I come back from an event, I'd write down some two or three bullet points that I picked up from that person in that conversation. When the initial meeting, actually most of every meeting, all the meetings, I don't really spend a ton of time talking about myself. I think we've all been networking and that comes off very off-putting when someone walks up to you and is like, hi, I'm Jay Sherrill, I'm an estate planning attorney. Can you send me business? Like, wait, I don't even know you. So I always wanted to get to know them, jot down some pointers. I would then put that into my contact management. I would then list those points in there. And I would, and I still do this to this day. If someone tells me something interesting about their lives, they're going on vacation to Aruba next month, I jot this down. So that way, when I can follow up with them, I can reference that in a personal way. The structure that I had, basic structure to do, was I would then immediately the next day email them, telling them something about, you know, it was nice to meet them yesterday, referencing something in the conversation. Okay. Making it personal. And also from their perspective, letting them know that I was listening to them. And then usually finding something of value to provide to them based off our conversation. I mean, maybe they're talking about, you know, it's so difficult to find good staff right now. And I just happened to have this article that I read about something and about that topic and send it to them. I would also then follow up with, friending them on LinkedIn and friending them with, Facebook. Then my next step was to be about the 2-week mark. I tried to set up a lunch with them and set up a time, either lunch or coffee, a time to sit with them again, but more personal now. I would always treat them for that. You know, even if I always just pay for it. Good marketing expense, a cup of coffee, right? And I would just spend that time with them. But from there, then it gets to be more difficult. And you have to really, when you have the opportunity to work with their clients, you have the opportunity to check in with them and again, tell them how great their clients are and how happy they are and all the work that you're doing. But I certainly recommend, and what we're doing now at a much more advanced stage, is strategically setting up connecting lunches where with that person, I can now sit them down with somebody else that I know, that I think they should know each other. We'll have lunch, the three of us, and then they can have their own relationship. But I would start small. Just the magic's not going to happen in that first meeting. The magic's not going to happen in that networking group. It's going to happen in the follow-up.
Right. And you know, you're right. The first couple interactions are sort of easy and expected, right? It's like, you know, it's great that you send the follow-up email and then setting the lunch 2 weeks later, you know, that's kind of an easy ask, right? Like, hey, I just met you, let's have lunch. But then after that, I find it really interesting that you try and set up these like smaller lunches with multiple people to add value to both of them, you know, and that's a different way to then add value. You know, you're not providing a resource like an article, like you know, so it's a different type of value. It's like relationship value, which is probably significantly higher than any piece of content you could send or something. Absolutely. Like that, right? Any sort of question you could answer. Developing a relationship is so strong.
Absolutely, which is awesome because you, especially in the beginning of the business, you don't necessarily have the work to refer back to them. I would love to say, make a referral, then the referrals will start to come in. But if you don't have the referrals to make, then, or you don't feel comfortable making the referrals, you can just make connections. At the end of the day, they want to meet other people. And the idea that this other person can help them will make them think of you every time.
Yeah. And so when you go to these events, and I'm asking these questions because, you know, starting a new business is hard. And I personally also just really don't like going to events. So I'm curious about what people that have had success do. Luckily, I've had my business long enough where I don't have to, although it would probably still benefit me. But you know, when you were in those early days, when you'd go to the event, you said having a plan. So are you the type of guy that would talk to everybody? Do you have, I mean, like, what is your plan? Like, what's your plan when you go to a chamber event and there's 50 people there? What's your plan of action?
Well, so first I'll say also, I absolutely hate networking. Okay. Cause I don't like it. I mean, I don't like when someone's rushing up to me trying to tell me on something and it's uncomfortable. You don't know any of these people. You don't. As the introvert, as we call it, right? I don't really like talking to people, which seems weird because I run a business and I'm also like one of our chief salespersons, right? But it was a big flip for me was reading the book, How to Win Friends and Influence People. It was like, it was very easy to have a conversation with someone by just asking questions about them. People love to talk about themselves. But here I go. I'm talking about with you this whole time, right? People like to talk about themselves. It makes them comfortable. So that was plan number one, was not to talk about myself. And if once I realized that, I was like, well, I don't have to worry about anything. I'll just ask questions of this person. The second thing was, even at an early stage, I would identify those people in the room that I wanted to speak to. You could usually tell by just kind of panning the room. I don't need to talk to everybody. In fact, if I talk to everybody, I'll never get anything done. I want to identify that accountant, that attorney. You can usually kind of spot your business partner because you know what they look like. Have I been wrong? Sure. But usually you can pick out those professionals, for example. Those are good referrals for me. So I would identify them. And then I would just walk up to them and introduce myself. What's the natural? Then I say, hi, I'm Jay. They're going to tell me their name back. How are you doing? Right. They're going to start talking. And it's usually how they're doing. They'll give you something to work with. And so that's the approach that I would take at the event. You're not there to eat. You're not there to drink. I would never really eat the food. And I wouldn't drink. Sometimes I would use the, you know, going to get a drink or use the bathroom to get out of a conversation that I needed to get out of, because you also can't just stand there and talk to one person the whole time. The goal is not to get the whole life story in that event. I had a goal of three, really walk away with three solid prospects that I could follow up with down the road, because more than three, I didn't have the time to follow up with them. And more than three, I didn't have the time to get enough in that first meeting to be able to get them to want to come to lunch with me.
Yeah. Yeah. My wife and I have talked about this a lot. You know, both her and I don't particularly like large events and like meeting a bunch of people. But we've talked about exactly what you're saying, which is just ask questions. And it's like, you could just like on a piece of paper, write down like 5 to 10 real basic life questions. Like tell me, you know, open-ended, you can get through any conversation if you just ask solid open-ended questions. And they're just the same questions over and over again.
And you can test this out. And it really is 100% true. If you do that with someone, they'll tell you that was the most interesting conversation they've had. Yeah. It was always such a great conversationalist, but I didn't even say anything.
Yeah.
But you listened. You can't fake it. You have to really listen.
Right.
And it works.
So that's super helpful. And, you know, I just think like from a real, you know, nitty gritty tactical perspective, that's just a plan of action someone can walk in with. And, you know, if someone is starting a new firm or wanting a little bit more business, you can just follow that blueprint, you know, right. Go to a chamber, BNI event, talk to three people, follow up with them the next day with an email, add some value, contact them in 2 weeks. And then maybe in 3 months, you've set a meeting with them and someone else.
Absolutely.
Or 2 months or something. I mean, that's
I've moved away from that marketing channel, right? Because of just time. It's very time consuming. But as I look at my business plan, I always envision that we've walked away from $500,000 worth of revenue, though, because of that. So I guess the next stage of where I'd like to be is to have a salesperson who they will do that. And they'll be paid on how much marketing and lead generation and clients they get, so that they can go out and hustle, market, sell. So, you know, that's I guess the next step.
Now, you know, now that you don't do that anymore, what do you do now for clients, you know, based on the size of your firm? What type of
So right now we really, our big push from 2021 into 2022 is to really nurture and maximize the lifetime value of the clients that we have. Focus on the quality of the service and the product that we do. Like our legal services are services, but we have taken the view within the firm to make them like products. Sure, they're not commoditized, but it is what we sell, right? We sell our ability to provide an outcome, right? Not necessarily about the service itself. So focus on that, because a raving fan, right, is going to go out and tell the world about you. So then once we started to do that, we said, all right, how do we help make that easier? Do great work to go tell the world about us. How do we tell them how to tell the world about us? How do we show them why it makes sense for them? How do we get, how do we make it make sense for them at the time we want them to make the referral? Recording testimonials, things like this, getting people to see that this works and other people are happy getting our services. And that was easily able to help double the practice just doing that alone. And then really doubling down and engaging those people we met early on, those referral partners, and continuing to provide value. And now that the business has grown, be able to refer business back to them and really continue to work on the back end marketing is what we would call it. Work on these people that already know, like, and trust us.
Yeah, that reverse referral is really important. It keeps, you know, obviously you want a referral. And, you know, in our company, we've tried to actually proactively talk to the account managers and say, hey, look for places to refer people, because that's just really good value to be added. But when you say that you were trying to, I think you said teach people how to talk about you or something like that, you're referring to clients and them referring you business?
Yeah, well, actually both clients and referral partners. We often found early on with referrals, we would get referrals from certain referral partners and they'd just be terrible referrals. The client wouldn't engage us. Then we would say, well, we don't like their referrals because they're, you know, every single time they come in, they don't hire the firm. It was really a failing on our end to tell them how to refer to us, who to refer to us, really getting nitty gritty. We don't just do estate planning. Once we're in estate planning, yes, but we even dove deeper. We said, this is the client that we're looking to serve. If they're looking, for example, there's no right or wrong answer to this. You just need to define this. For us, it was, we don't want a person whose primary deciding factor in hiring the firm is going to be price. Don't refer them to us. We're just not the person. I have somebody for you that really likes us. Just them and a laptop. They want cheap, great, fantastic. That's just not the client for us. We don't want someone who's been bounced around three or four different attorneys because they don't trust attorneys, and they need services and someone's willing to help them. It's just not us. So telling people how to refer and who to refer is very important. Even when I say how to refer, it's like, how? Well, we end up creating a page for each one of our referral partners. There's only a couple that they can give a link to, give a QR code to. So they're not just saying, oh, well, I told so-and-so about you, right? Okay, but you didn't really tell them how to refer business to your firm. That's what I mean. Same thing with our clients.
Now, what are some of the biggest challenges that you're seeing in your firm right now? And maybe you could give a little bit of just some sort of a concept of scope or size of your firm so people can get a feel for it. And then, you know, what do you feel like are the biggest challenges to get to the next level, whatever that is?
Sure. So, right now we are at 13 full-time employees and we just hit the 7-figure mark last year. We closed out 2021 with just over $1 million in revenue. And so one of our biggest challenges, and this is not just because of the pandemic, is getting the right people on the bus. Because the problems and the speed at which these problems present themselves and need resolution are twice as fast as they were when they were a $500,000 firm. And at $500,000, it was twice as fast as when they were a $250,000 law firm. So right now, and I'm sure I'll look back at $2 million when we clear that and we'll go, oh, it was so slow back then at 1 million. Right now, it feels like a mile a minute. We need to have the right people on the team. We need people who can move, because I've found my biggest challenge besides getting the right people on the bus is maintaining profitability and doing so. Because while it's nice to grow your top line revenues, if it doesn't necessarily bring you home any more money in your net take home benefit, then what's the point? And that's ended up being where we were last year, where we doubled the law firm, but I didn't double my take home pay. Not even close. And so I did all this extra work, all this extra stress, all this extra risk. Now, the answer for me is not to pull back and go, well, why don't I just make $750 this year and we'll just call it a day? It's to, all right, let's continue to increase the top line, but let's also be super efficient and super intentional about the time we spend and the money that we spend. So that way we can maintain what I want out of it for myself and my family.
Yeah. And, you know, there's a cost of growth. And there's a lot of cost to growth. And one of the costs to growth is you know, the overhead that you add to your firm. And while theoretically that can result in maybe less hours worked or, you know, being able to step out of the business a little bit more, you know, when you hit that seven figure mark, you start adding overhead employees that are not revenue producing. Absolutely. And you probably added them before, but
right. We had a few of those from last year and we had to sit down and say, you know, which ones are we going to get rid of because they're not revenue producing. Do we really need all of them? Or could we get one really great rock star to replace two people?
Yeah.
And we were able to do that.
So having two amateurs. And some people by job definition are not revenue producing and you have to add them, you know? Right. And
so the best non-revenue producing, I mean, direct revenue producing hire I made was our marketing admin. And that was fantastic. And she doesn't necessarily generate revenue. She can't tie her to a billable, but she's a duplicate of me. Now I have two of me marketing the business.
Yeah.
And that was a good one. Anybody who really wants to get that throttle, that was the biggest decision that we made was to hire our first admin there on that side was someone who could help market 24/7 for us. Well, not 24/7, but 9 to 5 every day, whether you were in court, whether you were tired, sick, whatever it was.
Yeah. Now, with your hiring practices, do you use any sort of assessments or what does your hiring process look like for the right people? Or is this one of the biggest challenges you're kind of trying to tackle?
So I don't know that finding the right people has been the biggest challenge for us is knowing when to get rid of the person who's not the right person. Thankfully, we have a really great team. We've only had to really let go 2 or 3 people, but it's a difficult decision to make when you have to make that because someone's life and you like them as a person, it's just not working out for the business. Making that decision is probably the hardest piece. So being able to identify it when it's not right fit and pull the trigger on letting that person go because it can quickly sink your energy and sink everybody else's energy. That's one of the biggest challenges. In terms of like the system for finding someone, you got to start simple. Start with a clear job description, right? And even if it's your first hire and they're going to be doing multiple different things, well, what multiple different things are they going to be doing? What hats are they going to be wearing? Because if you don't start with the job description, not only do you not have an expectation for what they will actually complete within the law firm, you can't really identify the skill set that you want to identify in the person. So starting with just a job description, then identifying the skills that you need to be able to complete that, and then asking questions. When you get your job, you know, job description out there, job ad out there, people start, you know, getting resumes in, and you start asking questions that line up with those skills. Like, so you're just, all you're trying to do is find out, does this person have the skills to do what it is you're asking them to do? And do you like them? So I don't have any crazy systems. I've read books on it, like the Who. At the end of the day, we're all limited in time. We could be sometimes kind of in self-help, overload, burnout. If you just keep it, you don't have to have a crazy system. If you just keep focused, you're asking a person to do a job. What skills do they need? And you want to identify that person that has the right skills to do that. And the other last piece that I found for us was never a problem because I made this decision earlier, was that we should pay for the right people. So you're obviously the quality of the people that you're going to get at $15 an hour is going to be vastly different than the people that you're going to get at $25 an hour. Would I rather have two $15 an hour, pay $30 an hour for two people to do the same job and they both suck at it, than pay a great person at $25 an hour? And you could do this all the way up and say, I'd rather pay for the right person.
Yeah. One thing that I started doing quite a long time ago was I started giving everyone DISC assessments, which is one of just the hiring profiles. And for years, I didn't do anything with them. I just was curious what people were. Yeah. And they were like $40 a piece. And then about 2 years ago, I started looking at the DISC assessments of my employees for the last 3 or 4 years. And I looked at their profiles and which ones didn't work out and which ones did work out. And like a clear pattern emerged when I hired the objective thinker profile. They were the type of analytical mindset that I needed for my account managers. But if I hired a different profile, like a promoter or an influencer, you know, something where they kind of could game the interview a little bit better because that's like sort of their natural tendency is to sell, but they're actually supposed to be an account manager. They didn't have the attention to detail. Mm-hmm. They never worked out. And so now if someone doesn't hit that objective thinker profile in the DISC assessment, we will not hire them.
All right.
Simply a no-go.
That's a great screen. For me, I have done it. I've tried it. I will 100% do it. It's just a matter of time.
Yeah.
And It's just, you have to be a super, for me at least, you have to be super intentional with the time. And I just hadn't had the time to administer this and follow through with it in the true way that needed to be do. It would be another one of those subscriptions for me right now. So I pulled the plug on it.
Well, you know, you could assign it to an admin and just have them give the test and not even do anything with it, because it just, then you can look back on every employee. Yeah. Even if you're not doing, cause I didn't do anything for years.
Okay.
I was just like, more, you know, like weirdly curious about it. And then all of a sudden I'm like, I need to start hiring the right people. And it really helped. So just something.
The funny thing is, they're spot on. I did it for myself. I'm sure you've tested yourself.
Really good.
This is 100% me. It's pretty funny.
Yeah.
I ended up getting a promoter also.
You were a promoter?
Yeah.
Promoter. Good. I have like this highly analytical, like introverted one. So I think it's called the artist or something like that.
Okay.
Not good for running a business. I'll just tell you that. None of my profile characteristics are good for business running. So, but I'm very analytical. That's where it ends up. So just one or two last questions here. You mentioned at the top of the interview about, you know, starting your practice, you know, because of this, situation with your daughter. I want to hear a little bit about what your life looks like with your work-life balance now that your practice is bigger, now that you've been in it for a couple of years. And what does it look like? Is it how you want it to look? And, you know, where is it going? Right. Talk to me about that.
So my life looks like a garden. It's only going to be as neat and clean as you keep it. And if you don't keep up on top of that, you're going to get the weeds. And so my life is not magically better or worse because we are $1 million law firm instead of a $500,000 law firm. I go through phases. If I don't keep things in check, that's when I find myself being at the office when I shouldn't be at 6 o'clock, 6:30. That's when I find myself stressed. That's when I find myself overwhelmed. So one of the things that I do on a weekly and quarterly basis is to really come up with this idea of my ideal week. And we know it's not 100%, right? But every once in a while, I got to get that thing done. But this is what the ideal week looks like. And again, it comes down to commitment. It's a commitment that I'm making. I'm leaving the office at 5 o'clock. I'm going to be home and having dinner from 5:30 to 7:30. I'm going to read a book. You make these commitments. And if you don't follow them, all that creeps in. So you think, I have all this staff, I'll be able to help out with all this stuff. It only creates more work that needs to get done, right? And you need to keep it in check. Right now, I'm at a place where I'm clearing out from that. Where we had a little overgrow that I have to kind of get the weeds out, get the right people doing the right things. And the key, I believe, you got to do is when you start to see those things creep in, pick them off and delegate them. Really think, do I need to be doing this thing that I'm giving up my time for and taking away from my family, from, or wherever it might be, if you don't have a family, what the fun thing you want to be doing this weekend, your own mental health, right? You can't turn, you know, rob from Peter to pay Paul in that sense. It'll only hurt you down the road.
Yeah. So if you don't mind me asking, what are some of the things that tend to, you know, be the overgrown parts of the garden? What are some of the things that you don't want to happen that can creep in? And then you mentioned delegating them, but I'm just sort of curious, you know, what sort of challenges you face in this realm?
For me personally, there's two. There's some back office management things where, yes, I'm the office manager. Right at this juncture of the business, we don't have an office manager. We don't have an HR manager. I let a little bit of the, what could be an office assistant or an HR assistant take some of that stuff off my plate. I tend to take and hold on to some of those things because I have to, well, it's the business. I'm the entrepreneur. So I tend to hold on to some of those. So right now we have plans to get that office manager in place and I want to get off that. But in doing so, I have to let go of some of those tasks earlier. The second one would be legal work. Now, look, at the end of the day, we all went to law school. We were trained to be technicians. If you read E-Myth Revisited, spot on. We go out because, and I did the same thing. You have this entrepreneurial, what is it called? Entrepreneurial snap, a seizure, whatever it calls it in the book, right? That you say, I can do this. Because I can do legal work, I can do what my boss is doing. I can have a law practice. I did that. And then left. And you have all the skills of a technician, someone who can do the work you're selling, but you now need to nurture all these skills to be able to run the business that does what you're doing. And so I still, to this day, find myself getting involved in legal work that they haven't properly trained, delegated away, and hired the right staff to take off of my plate. While I do have an attorney that works with us and great legal staff, there are pieces that I should not be involved in that legal work.
Right. What are your, you know, it's the beginning of 2022. What are your goals that you have for the year? Just last question. I just kind of want to hear like what your plans are and what your ambitions are for this year upcoming.
Sure. Sure. So our goal is to double again in revenue this year, but also double my take home benefit. So we're gonna preserve that, which means if we don't hit our goal, that the primary goal is to double that take home benefit. So that way we have that. In doing so, this is to help more families with estate planning, help more families protect their assets, help more families protect their loved ones. And so we want to do that while increasing the lifetime value of our clients by providing them with more value, providing them with more services, and really be able to continuously affect and the change that we want with the law firm in that we help people leave a legacy behind.
Love that. Yeah. Estate planning. I mean, there's such a positive impact to the work that you do. So I really applaud that. That's great. Well, Jay, thank you so much for joining me today. If anyone's interested in reaching out and just connecting with you, hearing more about your firm, how should they do that?
Oh, they can reach out to me at my email address. Probably the best is jay@Sherrill, spelled Sherrill-law.com.
Great. Thank you again for joining us. And to everybody listening, thank you for listening to today's episode. And we'll see you in the next episode. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.